everyone. It's 9:45, so we're gonna get going. And we're just waiting for the microphone volume to adjust itself. There we go, perfect. My name is Stephen Downs, and I'm pleased to be here on behalf of Contact North. And why am I echoing? Is that my own scream echoing? Okay, well, that's different. I don't see why.
Oh, you have a microphone.
It's the HDMI, it's
no,
picking up. Sorry about that. It's just one of the risks of live technology. So I'm still live here. Okay, good. So again, to repeat myself, my name is Stephen Downs. I'm pleased to be here on behalf of Contact North. And I hope that this presentation does justice to this magnificent conference, which I think is one of the best I've ever been to. So congratulations to Contact North and all the associated organizations and entities and speakers for putting it together. We're broadcasting live on the internet. If previous talks are any judge, there should be an audience of two or three people online. So, but that's okay. Of course, because we're broadcasting live, there will also be a recording of this video, etc. Audio recording, and the slides for this talk also available at the presentation page, and the presentation page is www.downs.ca/presentation/479, and you can view those slides. You might find them a bit small when I start playing with the screen, so you'll be able to view those on your own computer, laptop, tablet, iPhone, whatever. Not iPhone, Android, that's right. One more preliminary before we get going. We have a back channel, so, and you can see it there, and instructions for using the back channel. So you can use it with Twitter. Anything you tweet with the hashtag ICDE2017 will show up on the back channel. You can also, if you don't use Twitter or if you don't want to fill your Twitter stream with comments, use the back channel on my own website. Go to bit.ly/ICDE2017. You'll see a screen that looks like that. Type your comment in the little box at the bottom. If I have my screen tuned to something else at the moment, the other comments will keep playing in the big window on the top, so you won't miss anything. If it looks broken, just reload the page, and that'll fix everything. The back channel comments will be shown on the main screen as well as we talk. So you're not just talking to each other. Well, for one thing, Downs has an E in it. www.downs.ca/something.
Presentation.
Presentation. 479, thank you.
Presentation.
Presentation /479. See, that's how the back channel works, right? So it'll be part of the video, it'll be part of the permanent recording. It's live, there's no filtering. Please use your sound, good judgment when you make comments. I don't mind criticisms or if I'm wrong or anything like that, that's great. But you know, keep the language family friendly if you could. So I have tons of stuff, but I want to set the scene. And we'll set the scene, you know, the topic of education, the topic of learning, knowledge. We'll begin with knowledge. What is knowledge? And there are different ways of talking about this in education. Sometimes we talk about facts or domain knowledge or things like that. Sometimes we talk about skills or abilities. Sometimes we talk about competencies. There's a bunch of different words that we can use to represent this core concept here that we all talk about, right? I just think of it as content. These are all different ways of saying content. We could quibble about that, but you'll find by the end of the talk there's a gazillion things to quibble about, and the word we use for this is the least of them. Whoops. Oh, that jumps in a hurry. It's supposed to go one at a time. Oh, well. I wonder if it does that after this. No, it doesn't. Okay. So pretend you saw four slides with these appearing one at a time. So there are different schools of thought that talk about this content or this fact or this knowledge in a different way. You have the old logical positivist behaviorist tradition where knowledge or knowing is represented as a disposition or rules or skills. If you talk to people in computing science, people who are creating the XMOOCs and things like that, that's the world that they're still in. They're thinking of knowledge as behavior. The cognitivist approach actually thinks there's something inside that black box. They talk about knowledge in terms of reference to an external world. They talk about knowledge in terms of truth. And validation according to empirical criteria, etc. That's also kind of a logical positivist approach, but it is proven difficult to apply in learning. The constructivist approach, which many of you adhere to, thinks of knowledge, content, etc. in terms of meaning. Meaning, in turn, is expressed through representation, models, etc. And I know I'm glossing over some things, but that's okay. I take a connectivist perspective, personally. I think that to know something is to recognize. Knowing is recognizing. I have a story about that, which I won't get into right now. I think of knowledge as constituted by the organization of a network or the internal structure of a brain. And I think of learning as informed by learning theory, that is to say, the methods and principles by which a connection forms between one entity and the next. There's a whole domain in artificial intelligence now under the heading of learning theory, which is kind of interesting when I speak at education conferences because thinking is so different. There are some other theories and approaches that haven't reached the currency of these four. Operationalist approaches to knowledge, intuitionist approaches, especially in mathematics and things like that, functionalist definitions, which in education never really caught on. I don't know why. So, but let's get back to the content. Let's get back to the core of this thing. Let's get back to this thing that we're talking about. What do we think it is, really? Well, it might be a black box. A lot of people like thinking of it as a Lego, and you put them together, right? Back when we were talking about learning objects, the first model that came out was the Lego model. Today, people are talking about competencies and stackable credentials, right? It's the Lego model. Other people, especially embracing the more contemporary theory of knowledge as related to embodiment, like to think of it as a cell. And that's a nice metaphor because there are many different types of cells. Cells have internal structure, internal function, yet they relate to each other, and again, they can be combined to form a whole. Other people like to talk about atoms. And again, especially in the tech world, they like talking about atoms. And again, you have the whole periodic table of the elements. You have ways in which these different atoms can combine to form different molecules, etc. My problem with all of this is, even though it's a metaphor, it's still a black box. It hasn't actually informed us. It's given us, you know, a picture that we can use in our mind, but we're black boxing it. And I think we need to look closer, much closer, into the multiple dimensions of this. That's a tesseract. Educationalists love taxonomies. They love slicing and dicing. So do business people. The favorite, of course, is the Venn diagram, three major categories. And then you have the two, the square diagram, you've seen those. I use a tesseract. That gives me multiple dimensions because it's a multiple dimensional endeavor. And it's complex, and it's not simple, and it's hard to grasp. And a three-dimensional or even a four-dimensional model, which a tesseract is, won't quite capture it. And these are six of the dimensions of this tesseract. There might be more. It's an empirical domain, after all. So there might be more. So, what are they? Architecture, pedagogy, literacies, evidence, values, and skills. And that's the structure of this talk. Ta-da! I'm going to focus more on some and less on others. I'm hardly going to talk about literacies at all. I'm hardly going to talk about evidence at all. But I'm going to linger longer on the rest of them. It's so hard to turn the slides. As we look at each of these dimensions, each of these dimensions has a series of sub-elements. I want you to visualize, because we're kind of trying to do metaphors here, visualize this. We'll try it in three dimensions. Well, try it in two dimensions first, right? So you have two dimensions, 4x4, you got 16 boxes, right? Now let's add a third dimension, 4x4x4, you have 16 times 4, 64 boxes. All right, now I'm not going to do the math anymore because I don't have the numbers here and I'm not going to risk it. But add another dimension and another dimension and another dimension. So we've got several hundred, several thousand, whatever, little boxes for each piece of knowledge, skill, competency, or whatever you want to call it. That's how we need to approach learning. It's hard. Okay. Let's talk pedagogy. I'm starting here because this is where you're starting. I'm starting here because your day-to-day work is pedagogy. I know most of you are university professors or related to universities, so we'll begin there. If I was talking with a tech audience, I'd start with architecture. But that's okay. There's no right place to start. There are dimensions. It's not a hierarchy or a series or anything like that. And with respect to pedagogy, as the title of the talk today suggests, we're talking about personal learning. Now, we've heard a lot in recent years about personalization. What is personalization? So many definitions of blended learning. I'm not actually going to talk about blended learning. That's an interesting aside. Personalized learning is the dominant talk of the day. But blended learning will be there. You'll have to find it in the boxes, though. We have personalized education plans, adaptive learning with assessment, groupings by proficiencies, all of these kinds of things. But I contrast personalized learning, which I think of as similar to chocolatized candy, or a customized car, I contrast that with personal learning, or chocolate candy, or a custom car. You see the difference? So, how do we approach this? Some of you, if you've seen my talks before, you've seen this series of slides before, forgive me, but a lot of you might not have, and I know they always resonate. There's two approaches that we can take to pedagogy. Two approaches. Okay, there's 14 approaches, but I'm going to classify them into two. It's a framework, it's a model. We can mess around with the details, it's okay. I'm not talking ontology here. We can start with the content, the box, right? The skill, the competency, whatever. Or we can start with practice. I'm trying to do something. I'm trying to grow tomatoes. I'm trying to build a jet engine. I'm trying to understand quantum mechanics, whatever. If we start from content, then after we learn our content, we typically try it out or practice it. If we start it with practice, we try to do something, we end up with a result, which is content. Okay. So these are very different approaches to pedagogy. If you start with content, you're starting with an ideal state, this thing of knowledge that people are expected to have in their head when you're done. If you start with practice, you start with a desired state, and not the instructor's desired state, the person's desired state. I want tomatoes. I want a working jet engine. I want, what's the name of that thing? Quantum entanglement. Different people have different needs. If you start with content, you test for that content. That's what the practice does, tests you for the outcome. And the role of your educator is to test you, to evaluate you, to judge you, and probably find you wanting. On the other hand, if you're practicing, producing a result, and that produces something that's, you're trying, and the person at the other end is trying to help you succeed in growing tomatoes or produce a state of quantum entanglement. And then as the process iterates, the iterations are different too. In personalized learning, content-based learning, you have a gap. You have a knowledge gap. It's a failure on your part. And you will be corrected and sent back to the content to try again. And I can sit down and analyze a whole bunch of these personalized or adaptive learning engines. That's how they work. That's the core structure. And then the rest is spaghetti code. On the other hand, if you're trying to do something, each step is an iteration. The programmers will know what I'm talking about. You're trying to code something where you're rotating a cube in three dimensions. You want to see a nice rotating cube. You try it out and you try it again. It's a bit better. And you try it again. And finally, after 86 iterations, you get a beautifully rotating Borg cube. In the process, you had to learn trigonometry. But that's the way it works. Each iteration is an opportunity for more learning. See the difference in emphasis? The model or way of thinking of the content-based approach is a library. It's stackable, right? It's linear. You go from the beginning to the end. Sure, you have choices. You might read this book instead of this book, but you know, you're doing one thing at a time. The model on the other side is one of an environment. It's a space, it's a field. You're exploring, you're discovering, you're trying things out. In the library or in a book, there is such a thing as going from beginning to end. Completion really matters. In an environment, those concepts don't even make sense. Personalized learning, really is about the institution doing all the learning for you. I talked about this yesterday. Personal learning is really about you doing the learning for yourself. Two models of pedagogy. I fall on the personal learning side. From the perspective of a framework of learning, from the perspective of a way of thinking about learning, we can think of it in terms of tesseract again, and we think of pedagogy as that one dimension, and then the different elements of the diagram that I talked about are different elements of this pedagogy. Agency, who's doing the learning? Objectives, are you trying for an ideal state, or are you just trying to get something done? The elements, what are you working with? The iterations, are you filling a gap, or are you trying again? The outcomes, the roles, what are the different roles? The markers, what denotes success, what denotes failures? That's an off-the-cuff list based on the set of diagrams I just gave you. I made up that list this morning. So it might not be accurate, but that's okay. The point here isn't these are the elements of the list. The point is these are the elements of that dimension, and that dimension is going to be applied to any particular content or discipline or competency, etc. So far, so good? How's it going?
Great.
Okay. Checking the back channel, taking a breath, checking the time, trying to go faster than I did yesterday. Architecture. Oh, there's so much talk about architecture. I was kind of pushed into this a little bit by listening to Phil Hill yesterday. A little bit about the references to EDUCAUSE's next generation digital learning environment. I'm thinking about in what kind of learning architecture is this pedagogy going to take place? The personal learning pedagogy. So, what do I think about? Well, there's this. This is the JISC e-learning framework. It's old, it's abandoned. It breaks things down into sample user agents, learning domain services, and common services. It's not bad as it goes, but it was abandoned because it didn't make a whole lot of sense. It was just a whole bunch of things stacked together and then expected to interoperate. Interoperation is hard. It's unbelievably hard. And you can't just throw a bunch of things like that into a stack. There's got to be some more organization. Now, the next generation digital learning environment, and that's a moving target, and there are different ways of looking at that. So I'm about to criticize it, so I'm qualifying first, right? So, but that's okay. So the next generation digital learning environment from EDUCAUSE, and it's been the subject of quite a bit of discussion over the years. And it simplifies it, and it relates a lot of these elements back to the task of learning. So, we've got things in here. Let's take a closer look at it. We've got things like course material delivery, data warehouse, college-specific learning tools, etc. So I look at that, and I ask myself, how does that apply to personal learning? Well, now for the fun. First of all, we don't need an LMS. I know everyone has an LMS. I know there's no particular set of data showing that institutions are about to abandon an LMS at any time in the future. But if we look at learning, and if we look especially at personal learning that takes place outside the institution, as I said yesterday, nobody is using an LMS. It's only in institutional learning that we're using an LMS. And I forget where I heard it said, an LMS isn't actually a learning tool, it's a management tool, mostly for courses, contents, grades, things like that. Does that pretty well. If you're still gonna be an institution, you'll still use it. But from the perspective of personal learning, we don't need it. What else don't we need? Well, let's see what I crossed out here. Degree progress system, college-specific learning tools. I'm sorry, it's really hard to read. Same sort of comments, right? Yesterday, I talked about how assessment will be based much more on evidence of what you've done, personal portfolio, the result, the thing you made, right? Not your ideal state as measured against a test, but the thing you did. Can you grow tomatoes? Here's a tomato, you ask me, right? As opposed to, yes, I passed 10 questions on tomato growing. Let's keep going. Harder. Course material delivery. Adaptive learning systems. College-specific learning tools. Did I repeat that? Well, when you read the slides, you can see the X's. Again, here, I'm removing the features of the next generation digital learning environment that are specific to the institution. Because from the perspective of the learner, institutions are exchangeable. Who cares about the institution? Now, I know, it's a value proposition for somebody going to Harvard or Yale that they went to Harvard or Yale. That has nothing to do with the learning and everything to do with, first of all, the amount of money you have or the pedigree you have going in, and secondly, the network of friends you make when you're there. But learning is independent of whatever particular institution you went. And we know that because learning happens in all kinds of institutions around the world. People who graduate from the University of Calgary are every bit as qualified as people who graduate from Harvard. I say that personally. What do we got left? It's what we've got left that's important. Sorry. Content discovery creation. Data warehousing. Not university data, but my data. Dashboards, always useful. Advising systems. That's your job now. And social networking. So there you go. That's what's left. What do we make of that then? Well, let's look at the interoperable learning app, which is also part of the next generation digital learning environment. This is one of the little boxes in the JISC model, right? So here on this model, we've got, it's really hard to see. That's why I'm using the full screen here. Three sets of user input in one institutional context. At the bottom, we've got register, discover, install, configure, app management stuff. On the right-hand side, we have activity, outcome, credential, and artifact. Okay? Very institutional, very structured. It's, you know, an app as an academic evidence system, practically. So let's get rid of all that stuff at the bottom, which is overhead, right? If you need all that stuff at the bottom to make your apps work with each other, your stuff is way too complicated to use. I use HTML5. It works with everything. If I really need to send data, I might use representational state transfer or REST or RSS. I love RSS. Or maybe an API if I have something special to say. The rest of it is overhead. I mean, we went through the era of web services, web service discovery language, etc. There's a whole world out there where that's useful. Learning, personal learning, is not one of those worlds. What else have we got here now? All these inputs on the left-hand side, again, the persons or users, they don't have consistent terminology there, three different times. So I'm thinking, you need information about the person into the system, and of course that includes information about the context the person is in, who they are, where they are, what they're doing, what they're trying to build or make or grow or whatever, so you need that. You need other data as well from out there in the world that you'll get through RSS or whatever. What are the outcomes of this? Well, there's really two that matter from my perspective. One is the portfolio. That's a word used to capture a bunch of concepts together. But, you know, the stuff that you produced. A paper you wrote, a tomato you grew, hydrogen effusion that you accomplished, hopefully safely, etc. And then the other thing is some kind of activity log, because it's useful to have an activity log. It's the history on your browser, it's the XAPI statements in a learning record store, it's what you've done, where you've been, it's your travel history, etc. Of course, that should belong to you, not to the institution, and certainly not to Google or Facebook. I'm gonna have a fight about that. So my first effort at doing something like that was a thing called Grasshopper, and it has all of those things. I get input, either input that I contribute directly or feeds from people out there in the world, all very basic, simple RSS or text-based HTML, HTTP posts, things like that. Very simple. The kind of technology that we've been using for 20 years. We know it works. We know where it doesn't work. And my system brings it in, it slices it, it dices it, it organizes it into different types of data, and then it allows me to use that content to create output. I organize my output in different ways. Other people would do it in their own ways, but I have an email newsletter, I publish web pages, I have RSS feeds, I have a podcast, and now I have a live video broadcast happening. How about that? Everybody will have their own different kinds of outputs. So that's an interesting way of doing it. It's not the best way or the only way, but it's my way. But generally, you're going to need something like that structure. So we're going to generalize that on that a bit. So this is a model of the overview of the concept of the personal learning environment. My thing is in the middle. That's me. That's my device, my dashboard. Me personally, it's Grasshopper. For you, it might be your web browser. It might be your phone itself, whatever, right? I'm not really, you know, locked into any perspective on what that personal thing is. I think eventually, you know, it'll be a chip, you know, the size of a thumbnail that we wear as a ring or around our neck or as a watch or whatever. An intermediate stage that I'm working on right now is to try to make it a pluggable container, put it on a USB key, run it anywhere, stuff like that. Maybe that'll work, maybe it won't. It's research. This personal learning environment is connected to other parts, other services that are out there in the world. Yes, a learning management system, because universities aren't going to go away and they really, really want to grade you. So that's okay. If we can get the learning management systems to talk to other people, which they're not always willing to do, you should have seen the fun we had making edX, Open edX, work with Grasshopper. It didn't want to do that. MOOCs, massive open online courses, really easy. Google has the whole publishing protocol. Blogger, intranet for inside, chat rooms like the chat room we're messing around with here, simulations, and more. But the main point is, I'm at the center. I have my tool, my application, and I reach out and I grab resources from different places as needed. So what are the properties of the PLA? Well, we can spend a full talk on those. What information does it record? Who owns the data? What should it do? What does a person do with it? Etc., etc. Where is it located? Is it on your keychain or in your watch or on your glasses or whatever? The whole idea now is we have a network of these things. That's so different from the centralized, institutionally based model. The network of these things, each little red PLE there on the diagram, is a different person. And I'm connecting to these other people in my community or in my web using these intermediary applications. I might be collecting or connecting with a class cohort via an LMS. I might be connecting with a friend via a MOOC. I might be connecting with nobody via Blogger. It's kind of like my blog. I might be connecting with coworkers through an intranet, my friends and family through chat rooms, simulations. You get the idea, right? And then layered on top of that are the various other services, Facebook, Twitter, email, Pigeon Transport Protocol, whatever, right? All the different communications networks. I'm going to put telephone in there. People still use telephones. They use them a lot, actually. I can't turn off my phone part of my phone for some reason. So that's the model, right? It's a network rather than a centralized, institutionally based structure. And you see, the idea here is to give the person who's just trying to grow tomatoes the option to learn from Harvard or learn from Jake next door the best way of growing a tomato. And both of those will provide equally sound advice. Properties of the network, big questions that come up in this architecture. How do people find each other? How do they communicate? What are the communications protocols? The World Wide Web Consortium has a bunch of these. They're open, they're standard. We don't need something special and unique to education. How does a single personalized learning or personal learning environment work with other services? Do we need centralized registries? I say no, other people say yes. Okay. What is the value proposition of a personal learning environment? That's a key question. It's funny, people talk about the value proposition of a learning management system. It's always from the perspective of the institution. Lower overhead, easier management of grades and course records, etc. The value proposition of a personal learning environment must be stated from the perspective of the person. And value is, it isn't just what you can do. Talk to programmers about an architecture, they'll talk about, well, it has this feature, that feature, that feature, that feature. You remember the GIST thing that we saw a few minutes earlier? That was all about what it can do and not why people would use it. Same with the next generation digital learning environment. It's about what people will do or what they have rather than why they are using it. Usually the benefit is stated in financial terms, and we hear it all the time, right? You'll get a better job, you'll get employed, your credentials will give you opportunities, etc. Or maybe your education will cost less. That was the whole premise behind the business analyst talk that we heard yesterday, also known as the plenary. But I think that the value proposition can be stated in much broader and more human terms. The value proposition can be stated in terms of quality. I get the knowledge I need faster. I can learn how to grow tomatoes in an afternoon talking with Jake rather than taking a 4-week course. Sometimes it's bigger, sometimes it's better. The presumption always is that the university education is the best education. This presumption is being challenged today and will be increasingly challenged as learning becomes easier and easier for people working outside the institution. It's an existential crisis point for universities and colleges, I would say. And it can be non-financial goods, which are so often overlooked in the discussion of what is the value of an education. Satisfaction. It makes me happy to know I was able to create quantum entanglement. That's just an example, by the way. I have not actually created quantum entanglement. but I want to. Happiness. I studied philosophy. It was definitely not for financial reasons. And for the memories. And if you think back, the best part about your education probably is the memories. Here's the architecture as I see it. I actually did this diagram 10 years ago. And I've been trying to talk people into something like this ever since. People don't always agree, but that's okay. The organization of those boxes isn't accidental. Each edge on one of those boxes is intended to represent a type of communication layer or interaction between the boxes. Again, I'm not just presenting taxonomies. Educators love taxonomies, but I'm talking about interaction, causation, relation, value, the whole range of things rather than simple categorization. That's really important. On our tesseract, that's what the architecture looks like, more or less. I skipped one or two, use slightly different terms, but resource production, repositories, rights, environment, interface, etc. Each one of these elements of the taxonomy is a domain or discipline in and of itself. And where a lot of, and you've got to be careful not to make that domain or discipline the entire subject that we're studying in our field. One example, so I'll move that over to the side a little bit. Take community. Everybody looks at me and says, well, you didn't talk enough about community. I'm going to talk a bit about community. So community is part of the architecture. I know there's other elements too. There are two, well, there are probably many major models, but in our field there are two dominant models of community. Wenger's community of practice model and Anderson, Garrison, and Archer's community of inquiry model. Both very important models, each with their whole set of domains, you know, social presence, cognitive presence, etc. More boxes, in our boxes within boxes. But we need to put it in the right place, right? Here's where it fits. It's part of the architecture of personal learning. From the institutional point of view, community doesn't matter at all. That's why the, if you're raising money from alumni, I guess it matters. Okay, that was cynical. the Stanford MOOCs, et cetera, came out with no community at all, right? Yeah, videos, we'll pump some videos out of them. Values. Values is an awkward word to use for this. These elements are what I have called in the past the semantic principle, and I think of them still that way, but the word values resonates because they are mechanisms for making choices. Technology choices to some degree, but also choices of method, choice of practice, choice of organization. How would you build a channel? How would you build a conference panel? Apply these values. So, way back when, and sorry about the Spanish slide, but for those of you who are Spanish, here's a Spanish slide. I don't have a nice version of this slide in English, but I have a very bad version of the slide in English, and somebody very kindly created a nice Spanish version. But I drew a contrast between groups and networks. And you know, this goes back to my contrast between personalized and personal, institutions and personal learning, groups versus networks. I've been criticized, and appropriately, for those titles, groups and networks. Not really good titles. Technically, a group is a type of network. It's just one that's really focused on the manager or the person in charge. Technically, a network is a type of group. I could have called it mobs and communities, but I didn't. Can't be perfect. And there are four elements of these: diversity, autonomy, openness, and interactivity. Okay. Why did I pick those? And why can't I settle on interactivity, calling it interactivity or connectivity or whatever? Doesn't matter what the word is. What matters is the concept. These four conditions are the conditions for a constructive dialogue. They are also the conditions for an effectively functioning network. If you wanted to build a community, if you wanted to build some artificial intelligence using a connectionist system, you'd use these principles or something like them. They're empirical, again. There might be more, there might be fewer, they need to be tested, that's okay. Each one is subject to evaluation, is it more or less important, that's okay as well. But these are the four principles of evaluation. They're the design principles that we used for the massive open online course when we first built it, so completely different from the content-based approach. And they're the principles you can use to select technology. What are they? Well, autonomy means, well, choice, yeah. People talk about choice, and they make it the big thing, right? Choice. As though that's the only thing in the world that matters. That's the justification for so many arguments in education. It's about personal learning. It's also about pursuing your own interest in your own way. It's the John Stuart Mill thing, pursue your own good in your own way. It's autonomy, not just in terms of content, but in terms of device, in terms of what you look like, what you wear, whatever. Diversity, which is the flip side of the coin of autonomy, right? Diversity means multiple different things. There's something like 10,000 different types of neurons, for example. I think of Marvin Minsky's Society of Mind, where there are many different types of agents, each doing their own particular task. That's a little teleologically inclined for me, but the concept is still there. In practice, it means, you know, if you're putting a group together, include diversity. And diversity could mean culture, could mean religion, could mean genetics, could mean political affiliation or background. Make sure if you're putting in a panel, you know, especially a big panel, include some Marxists, some socialists. You know, they never get included. I don't know why. Etc. It means having varied content. Typical content-based education, you have the standard curriculum. In our MOOCs, we had a topic area and a bunch of things, and everybody chose their individual selection from that bunch of things. Why do it that way? That way, everybody comes at the discussion from a different perspective. If you're all the same, and you've all read the same book, and you all have the same perspective, really, you just reinforce what you already believe. You don't learn anything. Openness. In this very room, there was a session on openness just a few minutes ago. I mean by this open access to education. So I see things like tuition fees as acting against that. Really expensive tuition fees as really acting against that. And no students, well, I shouldn't say no student, I've actually heard this. But generally, students do not come along and say, I would like to pay more. We're not looking at a value proposition for students when we're looking to charge them more money. Although there is that small class of people, I know them as rich people, who are, they're prestige buying, right? So they have their Hermes bag, and they have their Yale degree, two of the same thing. To my mind, I don't think I'm wrong. Open activities. This talk isn't closed. You notice that? This talk involves people from around the world. Now, there are probably not very many of them, but they could join us. They could put in comments. Well, I don't have that thing up. They could put in comments in the comment area, although that one has sat there for a while, hasn't it? anyhow, you can still type in comments, etc., right? The access to this talk is open, the recordings are available, the slides are available. That's what I mean by open. Finally, interactivity is a bit tricky. Interactivity doesn't just mean interaction, although it does include that. Without interaction, you're not going to have learning. And I take that as kind of a duh point. We can go all the way back to Moore, the different kinds of interaction and transactional distance. But, you know, today there are many more types of interaction. You have not only human, student to student, student to teacher. You have human to human, human to machine, machine to machine. That's known as a bot war. You have human to interface. You have design interfaces, you know, so human to design. The different types of presences are also different types of interactions. So you have cognitive interaction, you have social interaction, etc., teaching interaction, so on. But more to the point, the interactivity means that, just to be technical, signals or ideas or content or whatever can originate anywhere and then propagate through the community or the network. A signal, and by signal I mean an idea, a thought, an expression, a fad, a meme, whatever. And they originate anywhere, not the authority at the center, very important. And they cascade through the network, and the result of that cascade is the creation of new knowledge or new information, new ideas, etc. The concept is known technically as emergence, and the idea is, as a result of all of these signals coming from different people, different parts of the network, interacting, reflecting against each other, you get a new overall perspective or idea that isn't a property of the signals or ideas of any single individual. It's what James Siriki describes in The Wisdom of Crowds. And some of the dimensions of these values you can find in his book. These values, I didn't make them up. I could have, I suppose. But they come partially from Charles M. Vest, who gave a talk at an ELI conference a number of years ago talking about why the university success system in the United States succeeds. And I thought about that, and then I thought, well, I better add openness. Sorry, that was bad. But it also comes from people like Dung J. Watts and James Siriki and more. These four empirical principles, selection principles, use them to guide your decision making. They are not principles of ontology. It's not a taxonomy. It's a tool. And this whole thing is a tool. It's a framework for looking at personal learning. I talked about how skills can be weighted differently how these values can be weighted differently. Sorry about that headline, I shouldn't say skills. This is an example from Aurel Mirabel, where he takes these four principles and weighs their relative utility as perceived by students and their perceived impact on the ultimate outcome. Interesting slide presentation. I only saw that this morning, so I haven't looked at it in detail, but it really looked good. Okay, getting toward the end. So there's where the values fit in our tesseract. So, oh, I've lost my mouse. There we go. Don't hop around like that, you silly thing. Skills. Oops, it's hopping around, so I use what I call the ARF model. I'm only gonna touch on this briefly. I got a bunch of slides on it, but I'm not really gonna linger on them. But basically the model, it's very similar to what we saw. Remember, I was taking apart that next generation digital learning environment. These are the four elements of that were left over. Aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward. So, and again, we're doing this for each one of our little boxes. This is my start page. It's all the different sources that I aggregate from. It includes everything from email to RSS readers to wikis, Google News, whatever. And here are some of the specific tools I use to aggregate. This is just me, right? But I use Feedly. Feedly aggregates RSS feeds. Very simple technology, which means I'm reading blogs and newsletters and journal articles and magazine articles, etc., from people who are in my field. Feedly does the job of bringing them all together in one place for me. I also built my own aggregator inside Grasshopper. You can see it there on the right. The Grasshopper aggregator does the same sort of thing, but does a lot more post-processing than Feedly does. And so I use it for specialized things. For example, my podcast system, where it harvests audio feeds from around the internet, organizes that into a podcast. So there's a thing out there called Ed Radio, which is a podcast of what people have been talking about in education. And you could subscribe to it and listen to it. Each discipline, each domain has its own sources of information, its own types of information, etc. Learning to aggregate, learning to choose what's important is one of the core skills of any discipline. That's why we made it one of the first things that we included in our MOOCs. The next bit, remix, repurpose. To remix is to bring things together. To repurpose is to reshape, to form, to mold, to make, etc. I've lumped these under making, learning, and sharing. And if you get outside the world of educational applications, etc., there's a whole world of people making things, discovering things, etc. This is a person making art references. So taking a picture of a skull to use in drawing. This is me using an application I discovered 3 days ago called Canva to make memes, including one for Alan Levine and one about butterflies because I like butterflies. This is somebody making rice slime. And what's interesting, you know, you hear people say, well, you know, learning can't just be about videos, etc. This is a video made by a student to share their learning. I love that kind of use of videos. This is somebody building, or it's instructions on how to build your own quantum entanglement experiment. You see, it can be done. It's just, and it's for like $200 too. You do not need a nuclear reactor. Who knew? I spent weeks studying Stirling engines. Stirling engines are external combustion engines. Our cars are internal, Stirling engine is external. All kinds of stuff on people making Stirling engines. This is somebody sharing on Imgur, and you see a lot of this on Imgur, multi-sided dice that they've created. Created, and then they talk about how they balance them to make sure they're fair, etc. This is people experimenting with jet aircraft. I've been spending over the last month or so learning about how jet aircraft function. I have a pretty good understanding how it functions. I still think it's kind of magic, and I really don't believe a 747 can fly, but. So all of this is stored in our portfolios. All of this is shared out to the external world. That's feeding forward. There are different types of things we can feed forward, images, audio, video, things, whatever, different places that we can feed out to. And I use a tool called IFTTT, you can see it in the lower right there, that allows me to create once in Grasshopper and then share to Twitter or Flickr or wherever, not Facebook, because I don't use Facebook anymore, because I have pride. I'm sorry, I should. So those are the skills, and that's where those sit in the Tesseract. Now, I said I wasn't going to talk very much about literacies. I have one slide. Here are the critical literacies. I have whole other talk about that. But again, for any subject, any discipline, any domain, to understand that, to be able to be literate in that subject or domain, a variety of these literacies come into play. Syntax, not just rules and grammar, but patterns, similarities, etc. Semantics, meaning, value, importance, outcome, objectives, etc. This whole emphasis on meaning in constructivism is one small part of the overall literacies entailed in a particular subject area. Pragmatics is the use of something, how it is applied. Cognition are the cognitive processes, description, definition, explanation, and argumentation or inference. Context is context, and I could talk a lot about that. And then change, understanding the varieties of change and the way change is manifest. Which is why you should not look at a linear chart of the use of a certain tool by institutions and project that that line will continue, because that just shows you don't get change. Finally, evidence. I have, again, only one slide on evidence. Again, it's a whole other talk. Sources, different kinds of evidence count as relevant in different domains, different disciplines, from the philosophical to the mathematical to biological, and I would include here physical, chemical, etc. But I'm thinking especially of learning and technology. Social knowledge, social sciences, linguistic knowledge, how does language work, how does communication work? Those are all sources of evidence. It's foolish not to think of these external sources of truth. And then the different measures that we use to evaluate theories, ideas, etc. within our domain. Again, a whole other talk. That's the framework. I hope you find it useful. I hope it informs your thinking, theorization, and observations in the future. And I thank you very much for your time and your indulgence. And I'll read all your comments after. Those of you who are online, thank you for attending. Those of you who are in the future, I'm still waiting for flying cars. Bye. It is running on all cylinders. Sorry. I can't shut down my broadcast.
Can I ask you to move your laptop to the chair so I can set up for the next presentation?
Yeah, can you give me just 1 second, please?
Tina Reed, contact North. Tony Bates actually told me to connect with you. He's going to connect us next week in terms of the ideas he's tossing about around Indigenous framework for bringing together and developing strategies for curriculum content.